Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is the 28th of September, 2016, and we're here to talk about manga.
Yes.
Chris, how you been, man?
I'm doing good, Nick. I'm doing real good. I upgraded mics.
Yes.
Recently. I was doing the Yeti for a while, but then I ran into some issues. My computer would no longer recognize the Yeti, and I was like, oh no, my Yeti's broken. Until I was like, oh wait, no, it's just this cheapo fucking cable that I needed to get. But then I was like, you know what, why don't I just upgrade? So I got myself a good Shure mic, and I'm just gonna move the camera here, cause I wanna show it off to you. I got like, that adult kind of mic, so I could feel like a radio dish.
Yeah,
like I could pull it in and just be like, hey there, Nick. We're gonna be, I'm like Casey Kasem. I'm like, this long distance dedication goes out to a lonely boy in Oklahoma. Chad.
Some Scooby snacks.
Chad, I want you to know we're here and thinking about you. Alright, now just play whatever.
My body went missing for a little while.
Yeah, who knows what happened? Oh, my ex-wife.
My family knows.
My ex-wife hid it from my children or something like that. Like, oh.
How weird is that? Anyway, here's the top three.
What a dark end of my story. And now, here's Meatloaf.
Most people think I was a jerk, though, so let's be.
Yeah. I generally hear good things about him, right? I haven't heard too many negative things.
I do recall some stories of him being kind of a bit of an egomaniac.
I mean, we all have those moments every now and then, right? You know?
I never do. I'm fucking perfect.
I don't
have any personality flaws like that.
You are pretty perfect, Nick. On like a scale from 1 to 10, you're definitely like a flawless 17.
I mean, I like to throw it at people's faces, but I am completely flawless and wonderful and handsome and smart and good in bed and all that stuff.
I heard when WWE was getting ready to debut the character of Mr. Perfect, they referenced you
he's not born yet. Shit.
Well, that's how perfect you were. They knew how great you were going to be before you were born.
They had read the legends.
Yeah. They knew how great you were going to be and did it off of that. And I think that was pretty cool of them, Nick.
They're like, you know, Kurt Hennig, yeah, he's pretty great for the role. He's a pretty good substitute for that Nick Freeman, but Nick Freeman would have a kid that would have charisma, I think. So,
yeah. It's actually the second wrestler based on you. The other, of course, being Damian Sandow.
Aw. He's in TNA now. His contract's just gonna get bought by WWE in a couple months apparently. Anyway.
Is that the rumor now? Not to distract us from manga, of course, but.
The big rumor going around is that TNA is going to get bought by WWE because they're so far into debt that they need to make a deal with somebody and get bought by somebody.
Or they just shut down the company and take the library, I guess?
What the going theory is, that if WWE were to purchase them, then they would, yeah, just buy the tape library and maybe pick up a few wrestlers' contracts, which they've basically been doing that second part for the last year and a half anyway, with Joe and Austin Aries and Bobby Roode and all of them.
Yeah.
So why the fuck not grab a few more people? Then Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow gonna be like, God damn it!
Just got here! Motherfuck! Oh, man.
Matt Hardy's like, I have come home!
I'm like, get out of here, you big hobo.
Stuler again. You cannot deny me.
I'm the broken Matt Hardy. It's just a character. I'm like, oh, fuck off. TNA is like the ear.
You cannot deny this, whether or not I'm doing it as a joke that people are watching it. Wonderful!
I think TNA is legitimately the air gear of wrestling federations. We'll have that for next week, guys.
We'll preview for next week, yeah. Yes. Next week, we're kicking off Horror Month with the scariest series of them all, as a couple of people suggested.
Yeah. I still have quite a few things to get through of this, but I'm planning to finish it all up, and we're going to have something special.
Let's tear the Band-Aid off and just get through the rest of it.
Yeah. It's... Man, I forgot how much dumb is in this manga. Yeah.
A short preview, spoilers for next week. It's bad, but we don't like it. I wonder how many people that's a shock to.
Some, See, that's the crazy thing is as I've done this podcast, I've definitely learned that a lot of series that we have a natural dislike for have very fervent fan bases. And and we've encountered them, especially with people who are like, hey, I disagree with your thoughts on this series, or, you know, in the less polite way of doing that. I'm like, are we, after this review, are we going to get furious Air Gear fanboys? Because I'm going to shit all over this thing.
There are fans of this series.
It ran for like a decade almost. This thing is not like a short-lived turkey. It ran for a while. So that's one thing I'm really curious to see if like the Air Gear fans come out of the woodworks essentially.
I'm sure that there is a significant percentage of those fans who only read it because Oh Great threw in a lot of fan service into that thing.
I imagine a lot of people who read it are probably no longer reading it because it's even when like at the part where you'd be like, oh, this is good, it's only good because you're fucking 12 or whatever, you know? So
oh my god, they're fighting and they're wearing skates, yeah!
Yeah, or you're like, oh, that chick's wearing almost nothing, or, oh, Icky's so cool, he took a shit on the floor, he doesn't care at all!
Oh man, that teacher's afraid of getting raped, but she keeps on taking her clothes off and inviting people to rape her!
I'm gonna save her.
Save it.
Saving her for next week,
store it like a fart in an airtight container so we can unleash it, and it will be more potent for being concentrated.
She is a special circle of hell that I need to get to next week.
Why was she even at the training camp? All right. We don't have a recommendation we're doing next week because we've been preparing for Air Gear almost through, and once we get through that, we're going to be taking some horror suggestions for Halloween month. In the meantime, though, we've got to go through our regular series. Let's do the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap, kicking it off with Black Clover. Last time in Black Clover, we were in the midst of the battle
Can I be like a radio announcer who's doing like the like radio play? Last time on Black Clover, Asta and friends had recently come to see the Star Diamond Generals attacking the city, but the Golden Dawn were there, and of all people, William Vengeance is pleading that he is not, in fact, the bad guy. Is it true?
He is definitely not unleashed.
Yeah. Is this masked man as innocent as he says he is, or is there a hidden conspirator in the mist? Find out this week.
And, so last time, Yami asked Vengeance to remove his mask, and we pick up with that, with our chapter, page 79, Behind the Mask. Yami repeats his question, and Vengeance says, you don't want to see that. And Yami says, well, what, are you ugly underneath you? I won't laugh. Oh, ha 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 ha. There, whatever. I'm not going to laugh if you're ugly. But Vengeance just front loud says, you think I'm the leader of the Midnight Sun? Yes. So?
As everyone would sort of expect.
But Yami does actually, we do see into his thoughts where it's like, okay, World Tree Magic and Light Magic, they're different types, so it wouldn't make sense for the same person to be using them both, but they've got the same build, they've got the same voice, he's wearing a mask, and also the feel of their ki is the same.
I'd love if he, like, mentioned in his list, he's like, I read the first volume of the series, and there's that very clear moment where it's a man in a Golden Dawn outfit being evil.
I do think that we're going to find that Vengeance has something going on, but as this chapter reveals, it doesn't seem like he's leashed.
At least when he takes the mask off, he's not leashed. That doesn't necessarily mean they're one and separate, but
they could very well be working together. They might be twins.
They might be split personalities, and the magic that they're using is what gives them the illusion of being hit. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. But Yami brings up a little bit of their backstory, how they met each other on the battlefield 10 years ago, and they fought together several times, became captains at the same time. And although they're not really close, they've known each other for a while. So, you know, come on, do me this favor. Show me your face. Get rid of my suspicion if you're really not the leader of the Midnight Sun. And so Vanjit says, all right, fine. He takes his mask off, revealing that he's got this really weird scar, pretty much perfectly in the shape of the area covered by the mask. It goes along the top half of his head, just above the tip of his nose, and even going all the way across to the back of his ears.
This is what happens when you give someone a 35-minute swirly. It's like, oh my god. Poor man.
This has a non-flashback with the sound of a toilet flushing in the background. So Yami asks, did you get that scar in battle? And Van just says, no, I was actually born with this, and they called me a cursed child. And even magic couldn't fix this scar. The people around me thought that I was cursed and were afraid of me. I was the illegitimate child of a noble. Until I turned 8, I lived in the Forsaken Realm. But when the noble lost his heir, I was taken in as an aristocrat. Fortunately, I had great magical power, and my royal tree magic was viewed with curiosity. However, even there they loathed my face. Also, the noble's lawful wife abused me. Fun! But then he met Julius, the current wizard king, who was just completely impressed by his magic and immediately invited him, upon seeing it demonstrated, to join the Magic Knights. And Vengeance was, of course, completely caught off guard by this. Well, what about but my face? And
ooh.
Julius...
Should we give Julius a voice?
I think we should. I don't know what voice we should give him, though.
I almost feel like he'd be a good Yulehauser. He's like, World Tree Magic! How sublime! That's majestic! That's terrific! And most of all, it's though your kindness is trying to protect everything. What wonderful magic! Everything's just great to him.
Oh, God. You sure love your southern hick voices, don't you? Notice you do that a lot.
What's that, Gomer Paul? Go ahead, Zooks there, Sarge!
I have been trying to think, like... I think we need a permanent character for me to do my Trump voice on, but I don't... It's gotta be a good one, you know?
Yeah, trying to think who would...
I'm sure we'll think of one. Let's not focus on that now. Anyway, Van just pointed out, oh, but I'm horribly scarred. And Julius was just like, oh, eh, whatever. Just wear this mask!
Plunk.
Pretty much just plopped it on his head. Why is he just carrying a mask around?
If you wear this mask, no one will have to be subjected to your hideous appearance. You'll be able to blend in with us other normies. You have to say
normal
it like
people
that.
Who talk normal like me.
Yeah, like I do.
So Vengeance says, yeah, you know, when he offered me the chance to do that, I was happy and I wanted to offer my grimoire in his service. And Yami thinks to himself after he hears that, I have heard a story like that somewhere before. Nice little, very impersonal way of putting it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he thinks to himself, I mean, yeah, he does look like leashed, especially with the mask off, but I can't feel any magic from the scar, so the scar's not an illusion. He doesn't seem to be doing anything with his magic, like showing me an illusion, and I can tell with his key that he is not lying to me. And so he's like, yeah, okay, sorry, I didn't, you know, mean to bring up memories like that, but Van just says, no, it's all right, I'm glad that I was able to show you this and explain things to you, so thank you. And so he's kind of treating this like, oh, you know, we're kind of closer now, we're closer companions now that you forced me to do that. But, of course, you know, again, you know, there is still some shady stuff going on here. We don't know exactly what the hell is going on, but I like that this idea was thrown out with people recognizing, you know, this shady looking member of the captains who's constantly wearing a mask and looks surprisingly similar to the antagonist of the series.
Yeah.
Oh no, I guess it's not him.
Even if this turns out to be like some kind of like quasi-lie of like, oh, well, no, because Leashed and Vengeance are actually just, you know, two sides of the same coin, or they're twins, or whatever. At least
they somehow found a way to deceive Yami.
But yeah, at least they didn't constantly never address the fact that William Vengeance, with a fucking name like that, just happens to look a lot like Lynch, and no one knows.
Ignore the dancing pink elephant who was jerking off everywhere in the corner.
Oh man, that's a really intrusive elephant. Can't you do that in the corner?
No! The elephant's like, I never forget. I remember what you did. Now take my vengeance!
I'm like, ew.
What could I have possibly done to deserve this specifically?
You're a gross elephant.
He's like, oh, do I have the wrong house? Shit.
He's like, oh, wait a moment. Oh, my bad. Well, you know what? That stuff washes right out of clothes and walls and children's faces, so you don't have to worry about that.
Stupid. You're an elephant.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let it be a warning to you in the future. Don't piss off an elephant. Or this'll happen again. And it'll be called for this time. Hashtag justice.
Could you just trampled something like all other elephants do? No, I'm a pink elephant. I must dance and jerk off of it on everything.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Anyway.
Ironically, I'd be a lot less fearful of that elephant than an actual rogue elephant.
Well, at least he was courteous enough to apologize and explain.
Well, I mean, he's only apologizing because I've used logic to catch him in his own idiocy. A rogue elephant's just going to rip my head off and start eating it.
Wouldn't have a conversation with you about it either.
No. And I'm already expecting Scotia would leave me to die the moment it happens. She's like, Daddy, I love you, but fucking, this is ridiculous.
This is even worse than that time the elephant jerked off on me.
That was funny. I mean, not for you, because you had to clean it up, but I laughed really hard.
I just rolled around in it on the carpet and got it everywhere.
It's like, what are you talking about? Who's Scotia? I'm like, my hilarious dog. Shut up.
Anyway, we cut back to Asta and the rest. And Finral is kind of under some stress right now because he just told his brother off. He's just like, oh shit, why'd I do that? Asta wishes farewell to Charmy, and Yuno, not to Charmy, but to Yuno. And Yuno responds by saying, see you, Asta, don't eat stuff off the ground.
This was strange. I know Asta's kind of dumb, but that's like fucking mental handicap dumb or something. Like, I don't understand. Like, what is that? Is that a thing he just... And he admits to it. He's like, I did that sometimes.
Yes.
It's like, how fucking dumb is this kid? What is this?
How vulgar and stupid is he?
You're dumb as fuck, Asta.
So, Asta and the rest go through Finral's portal and leave. Oh gosh, I've forgotten his name, Finral's little brother. Something really pretentious sounding, isn't it?
Falafel.
Falafel?
Falafel teleporty.
No.
That's his name. Annalisa will confirm it in the chat. Hurry, do it. I need this.
I'm trying to flick it up. I can't find it. God damn it.
I don't know if they have them. She says Langris, but she means falafel. She means falafel McTeleport.
Maybe she got confused and went falafel, Falangris, Langris.
Yeah, it's like that. It was a real Hodor moment.
Anyway, falafel. Falafel says to you, know, oh wow, you really shouldn't make friends with people like them, you know. And
I'm trying to think of what wacky phrase would need to exist that could be Hodored into Falafel McTeleport. Fuck you, you're awful, let's teleport. For you, that's awful, let's teleport. Falafel McTeleport.
Anyway... So, he kind of scolds, you know, for associating with such people And Yuna's like, what? They're my friends. What do you care? And, Falafel says, well, I guess it does make sense. You were, you know, a peasant. You were the peasant who was chosen to join the Golden Dawn. So I suppose that does sort of make sense. We kind of have this, like, branching conversation where, we have, you know, Asa's talking with his friends, Yuna's talking with him, and they end up saying the same line together. Asa's side of the conversation, it comes up much less naturally, which is, Fenrir's like, well, was it really okay that, you know, we just kind of left so quickly that he was your old friend, right? And Asa's like, it's fine, we'll just meet on some other battlefield anyway. Because we're both working to become the Wizard Kings. Like, no one asked you about that at all.
I guess he's insinuating that they're going to meet on the opposite side of the battlefield at some point. Because if they're both trying to be Wizard King, they'll have to fight at some point, I'm guessing.
I don't know. Where did Charmy get this food, anyway?
I don't know. Just places. Oh, no, what's his name? Gave her some, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Anyway. So, they both say, we're both working to become the Wizard King. And Langris is like, whatever, peasant. But Yuna points out, well, there's no law that says that a peasant cannot become the Wizard King, so whatever. And, anyway, my first step to that goal is to become the captain of the Golden Dawn. Which kind of pisses Langris off because he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm the vice captain. I'm ahead of you. Don't think you can overlook me so easily.
I didn't realize there were vice captains.
They established when Fenrir was talking about his backstory that Langris was the vice captain of the Golden Dawn.
Yeah, I guess I just forgot that. Is Vanessa a vice captain of the Black Bolson?
I don't know if they've actually established that.
Because I know she's one of the senior members, but I'm trying to think of...
And she did take charge when... Yeah, let's see here. Yamisuki go. No, they don't have an official vice captain.
Okay. Roger.
We cut over to the Diamond Kingdom. Oh man, Chris. The real Spring 12. The real, what the fuck were they?
The real six funeral wreaths.
The real six funeral wreaths haven't been revealed yet. Lotus reports to the real generals of the Diamond Kingdom.
At least it just had to do panel for fucking Black Clover where she's changed Langris's name to Falafel. I hope somehow through crazy wackiness that gets printed in the volume when it comes out. Yeah, the real eight generals of the Diamond King. Now, I think technically this is a bit different than that, because the six funeral wreaths thing was literally they had beaten six funeral wreaths, and it was like, but I have new ones that were actually the strongest. This, they fought three of the Shining Generals, and now they're like, here are the other ones, presumably with some other people.
That is true. We only see five of them. Standing there. Or, we actually see six people standing there.
Yes. Yeah, so we
five know... of them are wearing the new general uniform, which is this big furry cloak. And there is a person whose face we don't see who is speaking. I don't know.
I think that's what they're trying to say. I think that these were the other five members, essentially, of the group. Because he mentioned, like, oh, I guess those old guys were useful for something, but we're the new generation.
I do still get the impression that a lot of these guys are new to the position, because we see specifically that Mars is among them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would have just recently gotten that position, because he used to be Lotus's subordinate.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I'm getting the impression that, yeah, okay, these guys are new, and I think that, it's hard to tell, but I think that all of them have the gems embedded in them, which means that they're all, like, experimental warriors, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So,
I'm pretty excited of this group because should I ever balloon back up to my original weight, I have another option to cosplay as Fatty Mick.
Scratch Fatty, fat guy who's scratching his giant belly.
That he leaves very exposed. That he's like,
I think he's wearing a shirt over that. I'm not sure.
That's his skin. Because you can see the folds of his fucking tits, and then there's nothing underneath. Because all the generals are wearing, like, that shirt that cuts around the chest. And his, for some reason, dips the lowest of all of them, despite being the most out of shape. So, bravo to him, because that's a man that does not give a fuck. He's the most dangerous member of that group, because he doesn't give a single fuck.
Wow, that is a skin. Yeah, I see what you mean.
You think if someone would give a shit, they'd fucking let that much of their belly hang out? No. Not in the least.
The guys who were given the uniforms were like, okay, we've got to use the same amount of fabric on every uniform, so...
Alright, guys. Our whole gimmick, I think, is we're all going to have part of our shirts very, like, exposed. Like, we're just going to have our chests up. Fatty McBlob, you don't have to do that.
And he's like, actually, I cut a little bit further down than where you guys were. I wanted to make sure they saw all my belly.
Well, that's great. Thanks.
Give the ladies an eyeful.
Alright, so we're going to have to start warning people before we come. Like, ladies have to leave or it's going to be a sexual harassment assault charge on our part. So that's another headache.
Oh, boy.
Fatty, goddammit.
So the skirmish with the Diamond Kingdom is over, but more stronger enemies are on the horizon. And we got a little bit of character development for members of the Golden Dawn. So this little diversion, I think, was pretty good overall.
Yeah, I can dig it. I got excited by the end of it. Like, that's a good way to get me into the mangas, like, show a cool villain group kind of introduction. And, I mean, even though the designs may not necessarily, like, do it for me, I'm still like, that looks cool. We know Mars. We already know he's strong. Like, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, with that, let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on to Fairy Tale, chapter 503, The Last Sightseeing. Last time on Fairy Tale!
Last time on Fairy Lucy. Tale, the fan service cover page was for a character that was of age!
Lucy was in tight bondage. This week, the bondage continues? It does! Answer! Find out now! So yeah, last time we had found out that essentially Lucy was captured and defeated off-screen along with Natsu. He was just unconscious still from when the magic cancer struck again. But essentially Di Maria had taken them both, and that's what a large part of this chapter is you had to deal with the hero S&M fetish stuff for a little bit. The only, notably laughable part of it is when Di Maria literally, strips off Lucy's bra out of nowhere. And then she does the thing, she's like, don't worry, I'm gonna strip him too. Which doesn't happen. Even though, understandably, shit breaks down a little bit afterwards, but even in that moment, she still didn't. It's just like, no, I'm equal opportunity, I'm gonna strip you both. But the only thing who's actually gonna be sexually exploited in the manga is gonna be you. I mean, come on.
I mean, it's really fucking blatant, not just in terms of that, but also the fact that almost the rest of this scene is her going, I am going to make you cry and scream and feel and suffer, and I am going to gouge your eyes out. But first, I'll just take your bra off and let your tits out.
Yeah, it's like, that's the notion that she's like, I'm going to make you suffer, and the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to take your top off. It's like, that's... It's like a torture scene written by a college frat boy who's like, this is gonna get it done.
I mean, it's Lucy even has a cool little moment in this where she's like, even if you take my eyes, I'll still have my memories of everyone's smiling faces. I'll remember all of them. I'll remember all of the sights that have given me joy in the past. So if you're going to take my eyes, whatever, I'm not scared of you.
Yeah.
That's a cool little moment. But again, it's like, she still took your bra for no reason.
Which is, it's only really annoying to me because it keeps coming up throughout the rest of the chapter. But whatever. Essentially, Di Maria threatens her and is like, I'm going to take your eyes, is bringing her knife down, and then all of a sudden they cut away. Something happened, and we basically close in on Lucy waking up, The chair she was, shackled to has been destroyed. The shackles themselves have been destroyed. And she has blood all over her face. Essentially, like, the burn marks where, Vengeance had them. They're just covered. And she's like, oh, I have blood? And she looks over, and Dee Marie is there, basically, like, smashed into the wall with, like, smoke coming out. And this is really where fairy tales, like, need to always keep female characters sexy really works against it, because this should be, like, a horrifying scene. But Dee Maria doesn't really look that battered, because you couldn't have, like, enormous gaping wounds or dismemberment and have her still be kind of hot. It's just some clothes torn and, like, dirt, essentially. Like, I really wanted this to be like, oh, wow, he fucked her up. Instead, it's like, oh, wow, he pushed her into a wall and somehow half of her clothes ripped off or something. Just doesn't really have much impact when it's that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just noting, like, oh, monster. Essentially, this is just kind of cutting to the notion that Natsu is woken up within him. The medic comes in, basically explains, like, oh, what I thought was that magic cancer was actually end within him, and by trying to shrink the cells, we've actually kind of, like, provoked them and activated them. And we have to go stop him because he's uncontrollable, whatever, right now. Lucy's like, okay. And that's when fucking Evergreen and Brandish are like, oh, you should put fucking clothes on, you exhibitionist. Just like, this is really the moment for that. Cut away to Natsu, and he's... I know it should be a cool moment, but I can't help but, like, in my mind, write this scene with a fucking Linkin Park song playing underneath, like, where's Xerif? My fire's out of control! Stomp.
It's black fire now!
Yeah, he's stomping about, and he's pretty pissed off, and he runs into Gray, who's like, Natsu. And then Natsu's like, Gray, rumble, rumble, rumble. And that's the chapter.
I wonder if the power of friendship will save Natsu.
Yeah, It's what's shocking, Nick, is you didn't even get a page to say, like, oh, I wonder if Dee Maria is dead and never coming back.
No.
They couldn't just kill her for anything. The issue with this is that Fairy Tail as a series has become very formulaic, and it follows its beats so closely that a lot of these scenes just don't have impact. So even this right here, which is a somewhat of a new scenario, I don't buy into it because I don't truly think Natsu's, like, uncontrollable or unsavable. There's no doubt in my mind he'll be okay, and that this is going to end fine for both of them. Like, there's no tension to this scene, so there's really not a lot to get from it, unfortunately. Also, it sucks that, because they mentioned they handcuffed Dee Maria, essentially, with the shackles, so Dee Maria's defeated, so Lucy didn't get to fight her and figure out a cool strategy. Like, she just didn't fight her and had that kind of got beaten off screen, so that's a pretty big bummer.
Lucy has been sexualized by both female members of the Spring 12 now. Well, no, two of the three. There's one more, right? One more. So she's gonna have one more fight and get sexualized by her, and then she'll have fulfilled her role. Then she'll be done.
Who's the other female? Irene. That's right.
Irene. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'll happen.
So let's move on to Food Wars. Shokugeki no Soma, Chapter 184, Debt of Gratitude. All right, guys.
Last time, bear meat! Carry on.
All right, guys, I know Food Wars does a lot of, you know, girls getting their clothes blown up by super tasty food. Well, this chapter is for you, ladies.
Yeah.
And gay men. last chapter ended with Soma confronting Hayama. And Hayama revealed that he had joined with Central for June's sake. And when Soma asks for clarification at the start of this chapter, Hayama just says, forget about it. It's none of your business. Yeah. And get out of here. I've got, you know, I've got more preparations to do. I don't care what you think about this match, because for me it's just a minor stepping stone. So the time passes, and Kyuga and Soma go to take a bath. And Dojima's there, doing muscly naked man yoga.
I know it's like maybe that same thing that women feel when they see like a female character dude in a manga where you're like, that's impossible. Like those proportions are way too, no woman's breasts are that big and their hips with that perfect hourglass figure. I look at that and I'm like, I didn't even think a man's back could have that many fucking muscles to
it. I didn't know that there were that many muscles in the back.
that's like a 12-pack on his back. How am I supposed to compete with that?
It's like his shoulders have 12-packs.
Like, Nick, I think this chapter has told me that I need to just quit my job tomorrow and spend my entire life working to that. To getting that back. My regimen is to swim 18 miles every morning, then do 1,000 fucking deadlifts.
So, someone decides to join Dojima in his naked man yoga, and they start talking about what Soma has learned from Hayama. Dojima is like, oh, you want to know why the Shiomi seminar was closed? And Soma asks, oh, you know, yeah, did Hayama try and fight for its survival, you know, the way that all those other resistances against Central did? And Kuga's trying to say, like, it doesn't matter. Why do you care about his life story? Should have challenged him to a Shokugeki for the seat on the council. Dojima says, but you're right. Hayama didn't want to join Central at first. Flashback. To the moon banquet, that time when Kuga and Soma clashed. So, pretty much right when, Azami was revealing his intention to everyone. So everything was going well with the Shiomi seminar. Jun came in and said, oh, we just got contacted from this corporation and they're going to increase our funding. And so things were going swell. And, I was thinking to myself, this is great, you know, we've got all these projects on our plates. Once this banquet is done, we're gonna have all these different, research projects to work on. I'm not gonna have even a moment to rest. This is great. I've got to help June's research. And then all of a sudden, the next day, I received word that their funding had been terminated. As I went into a panic over the phone, all of a sudden, you know, Azami got on and said, from now on, Central will be the one and only face of the Totsugi Institute. All independent organizations within the Institute are soon to cease. And essentially what we learn is that Azami pretty much handpicked Hayama.
Yes.
And targeted him specifically, which makes sense. He was the winner of the Autumn Festival. So he specifically targeted him and the Shiomi Seminar by holding their research data at ransom, applying pressure to all of the different organizations that were giving them funding and forcing them to pull out, and then said, you know, I'll give you all sorts of great stuff. You know, you can have your own special research facility within Central for your personal use, and I can also retain Professor Shiomi as faculty if you agree to this. I'll provide you with a better research environment than you've ever had. And if you don't agree, then you're not gonna get shit.
Yeah, suck it, dickhead.
And so, you know, he pointed Hayama towards the Battle Royal for the vacant seats at the council, and Hayama just thought to himself, I owe her a debt of gratitude. One so deep, I'm willing to sacrifice anything to repay it. So he pretty much sold his soul in order to save his companion.
His It's complicated, okay? It's the person very special. Look, if he had a fucking locket on his neck, her picture'd be in it. In a platonic or not platonic way. I don't know.
It would be in a heart, but you would be free to interpret what the meaning of the heart was.
Yeah.
So, Kuga does get really pissed off when he learns about this. He gets really angry at Azami. Dojima drives home. Hayama wants to protect Shiomi and her home no matter what. And to do that, he must defeat you during this next exam. So it's like, oh, so that's why they call me a stepping stone. He thinks about this for a minute. So he stands up and dashes out of the bath. Doesn't even dry off as he's pulling his clothes on. And he rushes all the way to Hayama, and he says, I heard what happened. If you beat me in this match, you get to continue on as usual. In the end, that's all this contest is to you. A minor interruption in your work. And Alma is like, yep.
Yes. Got it.
And Soma says, way to diss me, you jerk.
He's like, well, you know, I do kind of hate you.
But, yeah, Soma says, I'm here for payback for my loss during the Fall Classic. I don't care how we got here. This is my chance to go head-to-head with you. I'm taking it. What the hell do you think you're doing, letting yourself get distracted by something that isn't your cooking? And Hayama is fighting just to fight. Whatever, you're so immature. Every contest has stakes. You're so naive. And what do you understand? You don't understand anything about this. And someone says, well, no, I do understand, because the seminar was a place for you that you belonged in, but you didn't try fighting for it. There's no way I'm going to lose to someone who's that pathetic.
Ouch.
And that does really piss Hayama off. He says, all right, you really want me to slaughter you? Then I will. This time, I'll bury you for good. And the chapter closes with, the time for the showdown has arrived.
Dun, dun, dun. Who do you think wins, Nick? Early predictions.
Well, I mean, someone's kind of got to win if he doesn't want to be expelled, right?
Well, they actually, to be fair, they haven't said it's a Shokugeki yet, right? It's just...
not a Shokugeki, but he's got to pass.
Yeah, some... but theoretically, he could still make the inferior dish and still pass. It just has to satisfy whatever condition. We don't know what the actual conditions of the match are yet, right?
I thought he had to be... I don't know.
It's just against the Council of Ten, but it's, if it's not a Shokugeki, then it just means... Like, does he...
What would the point of calling the Council of Ten to be placed against the Resistance members be if that wasn't...
I guess maybe it has to be scaled against theirs, though? Like...
I don't know. I'm gonna go Occam's Razor on this and assume he's gotta beat him. But, I don't know, I do get your point that it would be kind of weird... Well, first off, it'd be kind of weird for that to be part 3 of 6.
Yeah.
In their exam. So, I guess I get your point. And I mean, that, we're gonna get that answer eventually, but I am operating under the assumption that Soma's got to beat him.
Yeah. Well, that's where my logic is that Soma could technically lose and the story still continues. Part of me is, I'm gonna go out right here now, September 28th, 2016, I'm gonna say Hayama wins. Fuck it. Decisively. I'm just gonna start cashing checks my ass kid. He kicks Soma's ass. It's not even close.
We'll see, I guess.
He murderizes him.
I just want to point out, I like Soma's wet hair, because for two completely different reasons. When he gets really pissed off at him, he's like, you jerk, you're dissing me by doing this. It makes him look really disheveled and silly. Mm-hmm. But then when he gets really serious and says, there's no way I'm going to lose to someone as pathetic as you, it actually makes him look a lot cooler.
Yeah, it does add some style to it. I mean, he gets that kind of like almost, like, I don't want to say bad boy, but like, you could see what would make him a lot more attractive and appealing in that moment. And I guess that kind of adds the coolness.
Makes you understand why Megumi gets all doki-doki around him.
Yeah. So I like this chapter. You know, it does finally explain Hayama to us. It gives us some character development. And as you mentioned, it's kind of nice to see a chapter that's got some fan service, but it's entirely fan service for people who appreciate the male body. So good for them. I do appreciate it about Shokugeki. Like, even in its ridiculous fan service, it's equal opportunity a little bit.
Now, we're not going to be covering Love Rush, even though it is now part of the Shonen Jump lineup, the English Shonen Jump lineup. But we are going to talk about My Hero Academia, Chapter 108, Rush!
It's
the same thing, right?
Next best thing, right?
We actually start the chapter in a little bit of a flashback to when only 60 examinees had passed, with Shindo planning things with some of his compatriots from Ketsubetsu Academy. And B says, okay, we should you know, divide up in order to go after the fractured UA group. Because there are other schools that are getting a free ride here. And, you know, we're getting close to the end of the test. This is going to be a real mess here. And, yeah, we're kind of screwed. So, look. Maybe we shouldn't just be focusing on UA right now. Maybe we should be focusing on passing. But he points out, there's only, you know, less than half the spots left, and everyone's panicking. They're wasting precious energy running around in that war zone, and they've been blinded to the bigger picture of all this. We need to keep our cool, and we need to actually track people down, eliminate them, and pass this. So, showing that a member of one of the other schools is also an effective leader in this. We then flash forward to the present with more of UA students gathering at the anteroom. Kirishima and Kaminari and Bakugo meet up with Sero and Uraraka and Deku. And there is this really tense moment between Deku and Bakugo. It's Bakugo's like, so you passed, huh? And Deku's like, it's been a while. We haven't even talked since the Kamino incident or really in a long time. And Bakugo's like, yes, no wonder, given you had that power, that borrowed power, you've made it your own. Bakugo's smarter than he looks.
Mm-hmm. We've known that. We've known he's actually a pretty smart guy. It's just kind of cool seeing that their rivalry still exists. It's just gone to another level now.
Mm-hmm. But he also... no one else knows that, you know...
That he took... What All For One's inherited now.
Right, no one else knows that, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
So Bakugo has actually figured that out.
Yeah.
On his own, which I like. They meet up with the students that already passed ahead of them, and they're like, oh, wow, you guys got here quick, didn't you? And they say, well, no, actually, we only just arrived. Todoroki was here way ahead of us, but... We're all okay. Everyone else is kind of getting in on the skin of their teeth, so. I like, God, Jiro takes a quick little swipe, which is, wow, I was sure that you would beat us here, Bakugo, but it makes sense now. You had Kaminari with you.
Oh.
Todoroki explains that 11 people from their class have passed so far, but there are only 18 spots left. So things are getting kind of close here. And we cut out to Aoyama and Ida. Ida is essentially really keeping a close... He's basically guarding Aoyama at this point.
Yeah, I like how they actually say that, because she's like, I hope Ida is okay out there. And the first thing Deku says is like, Ida? And you kind of think that too, like, why would Ida need to be worried? He's the fastest person in the class, he's responsible,
he possibly he's smart. Hit by anything.
He would also be one of the first people done, you'd assume.
Yeah, but yeah, it turns out that he's actually deliberately staying behind in order to watch over his fellow students, and he is, in this case, specifically protecting Aoyama, because they're isolated from everyone else. And we get a brief glimpse of Aoyama's his breastplate, where he's got all of his targets attached, and two of them have already been hit, so he's very close to elimination already. Ida tries to give Aoyama a bit of a pep talk. He's like, come on, you know, we can do this. We can get out of this. And Aoyama's like, yeah, I don't know about this. And Ida is literally dragging him around by his cape in order to keep him out of danger. Yeah, Ida says, yeah, you know, I gathered a few people in one place, but I'm trying to find everyone else and track them down. Yayorozu was with the other group, and she should be able to get them out of here safely. And I was like, wait, so you mean just wandering around by yourself in order to track us down? He says, yes. Well, why is that? And Ida says, look, I found you, and I'm the president of Class A. You know, I'm one meant to lead the others. I want to buy the class as much time as possible with these legs of mine. That's what my brother would do. And in that way, my actions will reflect the dream I pursue.
That's an awesome speech. I fucking love that. It's so cool he actually takes the responsibility of class president so seriously, and not just because he's fucking uptight either, but he sees a real message in it of being a leader, being the guy who will put all others ahead of himself, it really encapsulates all of that. It's great.
And we then get an announcement that there are only 10 slots left. So 9 from UA need to pass, and there's only 10 slots left. Well, shit! And all of a sudden, everyone else, Yairozu just says it might not be possible for everyone to pass. And Aoyama is starting to get really doom and gloom, thinking to himself, why am I so different from everyone else? And he suddenly shoots his naval beam up into the sky like a beacon. And Ida says, what are you doing? What? Seriously, what's going on? And Aoyama says, I'm standing out. And he's like, that's not good, though. Why are you drawing attention to yourself? And Aoyama says, if you try to save me, you'll go down, too. I'm doing this because two of my targets are already lit. One more and I'm out. This is my gift to you. You will sneak behind those who come to claim me. With your speed, that should be well within your power. Non. And, yeah, and Ida's like, what are you doing? And Aoyama says, I've always wanted to feel equal. Which speaks to a surprising kind of inferiority complex.
You always assumed it was the opposite with him, that he had too much because he was always posing and shit like that. And even in this, it's like, I'm going to do the one thing I'm really good at, standing out. And it's like, oh no, I actually feel inferior to all of you. It's like, oh. Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, a swarm of pigeons comes in! It's like that one scene in Batman Begins where he calls the horde of bats, except with pigeons. Koda is coordinating with Tokuyami and with Mineta. Tokuyami uses his Black Abyss, to knock a whole bunch of people down while they're distracted by the swarm of pigeons, and they stumble onto a bunch of Mineta's sticky balls so that they're held in place. And Mineta is bleeding from the head while he's throwing. He looks like a fucking zombie while he's throwing. Tail Guy is with them too. He is there also.
They just had to show him. It's a shame because this is like the cool moment where they show that all of the remaining UA heroes are gathering together off of that kind of signal, and they all play some part in basically allowing everybody to pass. But, like, I mean, even Sugar Guy gets, like, a cool moment where it's only them, like, lifting, like, a huge brick, essentially, as a shield to protect everybody. I don't know why, but, like, the tail dude just walks up. He's like, Pink, I got somebody! Bye! This was all I could add!
Oh, boy.
My tail! Having a tail is a lame power!
We get a little moment from pretty much all the remaining students. Hagakure uses a kind of an inversion of her invisibility to blind everyone by refracting light through her body. We get Ashido, jumping in, and she gives Aoyama a really big little pep talk saying, you know, we spotted your belly button laser, and that's how we were all gathered together. You're the person who allowed us to actually all pass. And, Ida, continues that by saying, I don't know about equal. Perhaps you're just using a different measuring stick. Either way, this is all thanks to you. And, yeah, all the remaining UA students managed to pass. And Aoyama kind of just moved with his final thoughts, things to himself. Well, I just can't stop twinkling, you know. Kind of returning to his usual behavior, but in sort of a more humble way. So yeah, all of UA is really happy. They celebrate managing to pass together. Big celebration panel where Mineta is creeping still. Like,
yeah, it's...
Because there's this big, yeah! And Seru and Deku and Kaminari are there, and Uruk is jumping up and throwing her fists up, and Mineta's like...
You can clearly see his eyes are angled at her ass.
Like, oh, come on, man.
Dude... Everybody's so happy. Don't be this dude. Don't be him.
Stone Cold Blade for you. I deserve this much.
Oh.
I love the Rocket. Not what I want.
I like to call you Booty Rocker. Yeah.
You got something that I want, Uruk. Oh, boy. They actually point out that Shishikura, the disguise girl, has actually failed.
Aww.
Which is a bit of a surprise. I guess you got a little bit too distracted by playing around with Deku and didn't manage to pass at the end. Surprising.
Well, it's interesting because they built her up and they also name drop someone else here. I expected it from our first year, Yorashi.
Yorashi, yeah.
And you can see someone there. Maybe that's her, actually. No, that's someone else who's. I can't
tell. That's a fourth student from
the long hair.
Like that's it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But we know that this guy passed, the metal arm dude. But the rest of them, they're giving. Yeah, they're giving them details, so part of me is like, I wonder if they're going to fight that academy at some point for some reason?
Well, yeah, it definitely seems to imply that Shiketsu is going to play a big role, not just in this provisional hero license exam.
Yeah, three of the people they focused on aren't in the second part.
Which pleases me. I'm glad to get that. And now it's time for the second and final portion of the exam, as suddenly the cityscape that was part of the battle zone before all goes off, you know, detonation style. All of the buildings collapse, and an announcer declares, "Round two is the last one. You examinees will venture into the ruins as bystanders and prove your worth when it comes to rescuing innocent victims." So, all those people that we saw before are their rescue targets. I imagine it's not going to be that straightforward, though, because they looked very evil when they first showed up.
Or, like, they knew they were going to be doing something there with that. Like, maybe they're going to resist being rescued.
I can just imagine one of them is going to be like, "Oh, no, I've stumbled across this giant pit, and I'm going to fall!"
"Oh, and I pissed on all these crocodiles on the way down, so they're super angry!"
Who's going to be there and like, "Come on, sir, I just need to rescue you and take you to safety. I'm not going anywhere without my peanuts!"
Yeah, god damn it! Uh-oh.
Oh, well.
Did you break a plate, Nick?
I broke a plate.
Are you okay?
Everything's fine.
Can I call the hospital?
You can call the hospital if you can figure out what a hospital is.
Phew! Alright, I'm on the Operator, give me one hopsicle. Yeah, I'll take the delivery charge. All right, Nick, the hopsicle's on its way.
Awesome.
I got grape flavored. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Sweet.
All right, I got to reassemble this plate Walter White style.
Oh, yeah, I was like, you got to assemble it, and the entire time be like, "No, no! You don't lose faith in humanity."
Don't make me kill this man.
That's the best way to assemble the plate. Oh. All right, I'll move us along to One Piece.
I'm gonna make sure I got everything here.
One Piece, chapter 840, The Iron Mask. Last time on One Piece.
Things started to get depressing.
Yeah.
They'll be happier this time.
Don't worry, guys. Sanji's back this week. But he was here last week. But Sanji's back in the current time this week. Good things are coming this time. I can feel it. Oh, wait, no, it's all sad. It's all much sadder. So yes, we found out last time that there's a giant lab literally producing Germa 66 soldiers, and that they basically reiterate that and explain it within the start of this chapter, that these literally are exactly as they see, human beings that are being built. They're essentially built with the idea that, you know, they're 20 years old, even though it doesn't take them nearly that long, that Judge was actually someone who worked with Vegapunk back in the day. Vegapunk was arrested by the government, but Judge wasn't, so that's why he's kind of in the situation he is. But all the soldiers, basically, when one dies, a new one just fills in the spot for him, and that's what they do to keep their army constantly at power. And Sanji tells him, like, "Knock it off, I'm gonna be sick." So, I forget which one this is. Neji?
Neji is the one who beat up the servant.
Yeah, so Neji, I think, actually, this is Yon, no, not, this is Ichiji, who comes up saying, "When I heard you were a pirate, I thought you grew up a bit." And then Neji's like, "Yeah, and it turned out you're as big a disappointment as ever."
Yonji is the one who led, Niji's the one who beat up the girl. Yonji is the one who led him into this lab, and Ichiji is the oldest one, the most.
He's the one who.
The most holier than thou, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And Sanji kicks Nichi in the face for what he did to Cosette. And mm-hmm. I kind of like this, because he starts, like, trying to beat his ass, and Ichiji's like, hey, don't forget about that hostage we have, and essentially the Nichi uses that to basically a sneak attack on him. But I love Nichi's response. He's like, oh, you did it for the servant? If I had known that, I wouldn't have smashed her face. We can make her a personal servant if you want, if you don't mind her being seriously wounded. I almost like the idea. They were like, I didn't realize you had the hots for her. Well, we can just make her your fucking pet if you want. My bad, bro. It's like, wow, you guys are assholes.
Cassette for Straw Hat.
Yeah, all right.
But yeah, and Niji wraps it all up by saying, welcome back to the Vinsmoke family, Sanji. I think it's high time that we reestablish the hierarchy here. You are a failure. Oh. Cue a very sad flashback. Sanji had a pretty sad backstory when he was first introduced. But it was mostly for the sake of showing that he and Zeph had a very close, if outwardly, violent bond.
Well, that's the thing, is that every Straw Hat has a sad flashback, but they're all beautiful because they're all about, like, a touching love between two people, and usually mm-hmm. one part of the party dies in the process. You know, Zeph is one of the few exceptions that he's actually still alive, but, you know, that's the kind of thing the Straw Hat stories go with. This is a flashback that's just sad, because there is no love for Sanji in this. There's the insinuation that his mother might have cared about him, but
mm-hmm. the closest thing that we get is that Reiju is the least assholish to him.
And yet she's still kind of a bitch to him, because she's like...
It kind of makes her worse in a way.
Yeah, honestly. She's like, I would love to stand up for you, but then they pick on me.
So I'm too selfish to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to get picked on.
Essentially all five of Judge's children were wielded by the concentrated powers of advanced science. You were born to be greater than human, and you will be unbound by the foolish, naive ways of the world, grow to eventually lead your own military forces, and one day rule Jabba 66 with the ever-evolving power of science! And so they began this really harsh training, and Sanji lagged significantly behind the other four. Essentially, he was a regular kid compared to these four eugenics-created monstrosity kids.
Superhuman kids, yeah. And I'm actually really glad about that, because when they started to explain all this stuff, I was like, oh, is that like a way to justify why Sanji's so superhumanly strong, is that he was like a genetic experiment, and that's why like his kicks are so powerful? Because I liked it a lot more when it was just he had really strong kicks because it's what he worked on, he lived with a bunch of pirates, and that's still the case. It turns out he was completely normal.
And we get this big montage of Sanji training. He goes through this, you know, life-threatening training where all the other kids are doing just fine and he has to be rescued because he nearly drowns when they're supposed to swim essentially across the ocean. He starts expressing interest in food, feeding these little animals that he finds around, and his brothers beat up the animals and beat him up for trying to feed them. There's a great little panel where he gets into, he's doing kendo training with Niji. He just swings the shinai, and it breaks over Niji's head, and then Niji's like... and everyone's just like, why is Sanji so weak? Seriously, why is he so far behind everyone else? This is ridiculous. Ichiji and Niji and Yonji are making excellent progress. Their exoskeletons are developing well. They have incredible resilience and strength, equivalent to full-grown men already. But Sanji is delicate. He's a failure. The manipulation of bloodline elements should have worked for all four children, yet somehow he is no different than the way he was before. He is nothing but a human. And it's interesting that the scientist who's speaking with Judge... Is this Vinsmoke, or is he... Not Vegapunk.
Vegapunk?
No, they'd give Vegapunk his own introduction. Vegapunk and him, I presume, are no longer working together at this point. Because I presume that Germa 66 was... Well, no, because that's been an inherited thing, I think, with the Vinsmokes. But I think they're separated at this point.
But he notes specifically Ichiji and Niji and Yonji, but not Reiju, which leads me to believe that she's somehow different from the other kids in intent and design.
She's superhuman like the rest of them, because you can see her doing tests along with them, but she is zero, which would strike definitely as strange, considering the other kids are all numbered, you know, in a logical order. She's like the Yami obvious one off the top.
Right.
Also the only daughter, and in that scenario, they're comparing all sons, so maybe that's the logic, but...
Maybe.
It also does have to be kind of curious that she's the only girl and their mother is not actually shown in any way, shape, or form. So, who knows?
I like the little detail that Sanji is hanging out in his room, feeding animals like he's not supposed to again, and he's reading Nolan the Liar's Devil Fruit, Nolan the Liar thing in a Devil Fruit book. So there's the book that he learned about the invisibility fruit from.
Yeah.
That he wanted to peep on women with. The dream that I've had since I was too young to want to see booze.
Well, a lot of people are thinking that maybe he wanted the fruit then so he could turn invisible and stop being beaten by his family, which is kind of sad, and I'm choosing to ignore that because it's
much funnier. No, he just wanted to see tits!
It's much funnier to think Sanji just wanted to peep on some chicks changing every so often.
We saw in the last chapter that he was still a lusty little kid when he was working with Zeph, and I'm gonna stick with that. Because it's sad enough that he gets turned to the kid in the Iron Mask. Judge stormed into the room, got pissed off that he was feeding the rat in his room, is like, never cook again. He said, you don't have any talent by birth like your siblings, which means you must work 10 times, 100 times as hard to make up the difference. Don't let me down. Things continued, still didn't progress. Still got beaten up by his siblings, and we do get that little moment where Reiju is just like, no, I have to laugh at you, because otherwise they'd pick on me too. There is the detail that she is actually treating Sanji's wounds.
She's not completely evil, but it is one of those things where you're like, yeah, but the fact that you're compliant with it just to save yourself is not... It doesn't absolve you from it.
It's a weird thing, and I'm wondering what Oda's gonna do with her. Because it is really sort of a double-edged sword. I don't understand... It's not that I don't understand, but I'm curious if what way we're supposed to be interpreting it. If we're supposed to hate her more, if we're supposed to show sympathy for her situation.
I think
because, on the one hand, we see that she has that element where she is a little bit concerned for Sanji. When he goes missing, she is actually wondering where he is. But... She has those concerns, and she's still not extending a hand to help, even now that they're adults.
I think you're meant to see that she does. Like, she's the only person of the Vinsmoke family that Sanji even seems to be okay being around, period. He still notes that he didn't like her early at points, I believe. Mm-hmm. But considering the, level of disdain he has for everyone else, it's clear he has a slightly different relationship with her. And I think they are setting up for her to have a change of heart, ultimately. It's really interesting, just considering this, and I'm honestly even... what's her name? The cook that got hit. Castella?
Cassette?
With Cassette and Pudding and all these all these female characters specifically... in Sanji's life right now, where they're all going to kind of end up and play into this. So I'm really kind of curious. Especially, again, because they know that he's like his mother, but we don't see her at all.
Mm-hmm. And, we get to close things off. They hold a funeral for Sanji. As a judge says, oh, what a waste of life. An unthinkable shipwreck. I mourn. My 5 children were meant to lead Germa into the future together. I have lost a promising son. And, Sanji was still around. This isn't the shipwreck that, you know, he's not referring to the actual shipwreck where he was lost at sea and, you know, he survived with Zeth. He was still around at this point. They stuck an iron mask on him and locked him up.
Yes.
I don't like Judge.
Now, I mentioned on Twitter, but this was kind of the chapter I was waiting for. I wasn't crazy on Judge that first chapter we kind of got to see. And just because what he did didn't really feel distinct. None of the evil really felt like it had much character to it yet. It was just kind of acts that felt not distinct enough for One Piece yet. This is the chapter that really, like, hammers it in. Like, oh, this is what kind of villain he is. Like, his whole speech about the value of a life and how you're a failure if you can't attain these things, how you're nothing because you can't do what they want to. You're just a failure. Stop chasing your mother's shadows. Seeing the kids.
Stop being kind. Stop serving other people. You are meant to rule.
Yeah, the nobility, royalty part of it, which is a big theme within One Piece in general. Seeing the kids, how they despised him just because he was always having to be rescued and needed help and wasn't as strong as they were. And just, you know, boys picking on boys, too. But it's all these things added up, and this feels a lot more, like, whole now. And it has that kind of Oda storytelling quality to it that makes it a lot more interesting to me.
Good chapter.
It's very good. I'll be curious to see, because I also kind of mentioned this, too. I think I actually said this last week, but this is essentially the only time we've had a Straw Hat outside of Luffy get, like, a second flashback to them, like a second kind of thing.
Makes me curious if any of the others are going to get that.
Yeah. I imagine Frankie will. They referenced his father being a big pirate. Yeah, so maybe
I can see one for Frankie.
Maybe Nami if they want to do her.
I don't know about Nami because she feels very complete.
She does, but I've heard people try to explain, like, no, maybe her mom is someone important. I mean,
I could definitely see one for Robin because she's very much tied into the lore of the series.
I feel like there has to be one for Zoro at some point. I feel like
because his definitely seems the most lacking by comparison at this point.
It feels very simple.
Ever since we got Luffy's big thing about himself and his brothers, it really has kind of driven home that Zoro's has felt the simplest and maybe not the least tragic. Well, it might be.
It is the least.
It might be.
It is, because there really is no, like, there's
well,
no...
Well, let's go through him. Luffy lost his brother.
Even before you even count that, Luffy was, because of his actions, directly led to his idol losing a body part. His idol was maimed because of it. And a lot of that plays into
Up until we got the Sabo one, though, I still would have said, I would have said that Luffy had the least tragic backstory because nobody died in his.
Yeah, but that's the thing I think that made it big is that in Zoro's, fucking Kuina falls down the stair because she's a fucking klutz. Like, just all of a sudden she fell down the stairs and died.
This master swordswoman who Zoro could never defeat in battle tripped and fell down some stairs and died.
It's not like Zoro said something that caused her to rush and fall down the stairs or anything like that. Like, Zoro wasn't cause of her death in any way. So I always felt Luffy's was sadder just because he always had to kind of live with that guilt of, like, you protected me and lost your arm because of it.
You got this thing with Sanji. Chopper was responsible for his idol dying indirectly because he didn't know which mushrooms were poisonous.
Yeah. Ugh.
Nami had her brother figure die and was put into a life of slavery. Robin, everyone around her died if they tried to help her. Frankie, his idol was taken away to be killed.
Because of his actions.
Because of Frankie. And Brooke, his entire crew died.
And he lived in complete isolations for 50 years.
For years. There was that one flashback where we saw what all the young Straw Hats were up to, and Brooke was just on a ship alone. So, yeah, Zoro's is the least tragic at this point, by a long shot. So I do think that, he could really benefit, and I think that maybe when we get something that focuses more on Zoro, because it feels like now that we've gotten this big focus on Sanji, that Zoro would have to have something like that, because he's definitely been away from getting any focus for a while. And maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, but at some point I think he's due for a bunch of focus.
It could easily happen in Wano. That would seem like a good place to do it.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to talk a little bit about Red Sprite. We're going to talk about Chapter 4, Excalibur. This chapter was... A lot of it was introducing us to the different members of the crew, aside from just, you know, Mono and Tatsu.
Oh, you're going to irritate me, Nick. Because my logic is that the Promised Neverland goes before Red Sprite because when you alphabetize, you don't count the word the.
You know... We gotta do Red Sprite
right now. God damn it. God damn it.
We might switch it around next week. I don't know.
Go ahead.
We get some really weird names for these characters, like the one that Tatsu appoints as the Arm Control Minister because he used the arms when they were abducting a truck with some soldiers in it. His name is Libelula.
Yeah.
Libelula. Libelula. He makes this bald, punk-looking guy named Gannett, essentially makes him the interrogator. The cook is Habakkuk.
Habakkuk?
Habakkuk.
Habakkuk.
Medical guy is Siegel. A guard is Panjan. Panjan? Panjan? Panjan?
I think Panjan.
And the pilot, who is the slightly older woman that got a little bit of focus in previous chapters, his name is goes by Fall, which is stated to be a nickname. And Tatsu's like, isn't that kind of bad luck if our pilot's named Fall? And I love the response, which is, well, if you don't like it, you just call me Hey, are you there? That's a great little line.
Yeah.
I like Fall. He's like my favorite character right now.
Go, Fall!
Yeah, Fall! Off straw hat. Tatsu talks a little bit with Mono about what they're going to do. They say that their friend Alfred is going to be the first person they're going to try and reunite with because he apparently escaped several years before, a year after he was abducted. And so Al is going to be their first target. They talk a little bit about what their status is in terms of what the world knows about them. They have a little bit of an exchange with Fall because, Gannett reports that, the truck that they captured has a bunch of, food in the cargo. There's bread and cheese and ham. There is, all this stuff. And then Fall says, that kind of makes me wish that there was wine that we could have. And Tuts is like, yeah, I want to try wine too. I'm like, you're not old enough to drink though. Tuts says, don't worry, I'll decide the laws of Begonia to make it legal for me to drink.
I want this to become a real country so he does make all those shitty rules. It's essentially like King Tommen in Game of Thrones where he's like, I outlaw beets!
God damn it. I do really like this chapter, honestly. There's still a little bit more to go, but it did really help to have a little bit of humor injected in the series, and it makes the characters seem a little bit more than just their role in the story currently. I like that a little bit of time is being taken to introduce, okay, here are the different members of the crew who aren't the super special lightning-powered people. These are just the regular guys that are going to be part of the main supporting cast.
Helps to start building the idea of this group being a family, which is going to be kind of a big crux to the story, I imagine.
And then we cut over to Eden. I don't know if this character is actually named. He's referred to as, Your Excellency.
Atlas, I think, is his name?
Right.
Yeah, I thought they named him last time.
Right. So Atlas comes into this meeting of all these people who are panicking over Tatsu's actions in the last couple of chapters, where he made a big scene and broadcast his declaration of war and such. And Atlas shows up and he says, hello, my fellow countrymen. No, all of you relax. Yeah, I'm the one who's late to the meeting. Come on, calm down. And because everyone's standing at attention, all tense. And they're all still clearly nervous to be around him, even though he's putting on this show of camaraderie. And So they talk about you know, some of the events, and one of them brings up, you know, like, okay, look, you know, this big thing happened at our in the heart of our country at our most prestigious festival. How did this happen? How did those criminals escape? When, especially when you consider that six Ash soldiers were present, and the Ash soldiers given this very ominous panel of the six of them gathered together, which definitely seems to imply that they're going to be very important antagonists in the future. Mm. And Atlas says, they're not to blame for this. I gave them the orders to stand down. You know, even in these types of situations, their powers are not to be revealed to the public, and therefore I ordered them to stand down until we regain control of the broadcast. Speaking of which, go ahead.
If he weren't, I almost feel like this would be a good dude to be Donald Trump.
If he weren't so dignified.
Yeah, if he... Yeah, like, if he were just a little bit more unhinged.
He's too good an evil leader.
Yeah, like, he seems too competent.
Exactly. And he then says, yeah, I order them to stand down until we regain control of the broadcast. Speaking of which, broadcasting director stands up. When Blackburn ordered the destruction of the broadcasting tower, it was a difficult decision. I thought you were beyond saving, but you miraculously survived. Seeing you standing here now brings me great joy. This must be the goddess Edenia's divine protection. She has given you the opportunity to receive your punishment. What? Let there be light. And there's this blast of light and smoke, and when it clears, the guy's dropped down into his seat and his face has been scorched off.
Fucking incinerated.
This is a great introduction to this character. This is so... I mean, it's such a stereotypical, you have failed me for the last time moment. But he carries himself with such dignity and restraint. And is the ruthlessness on display is really great. I love this introduction to this character. I really, really like it. And that combined with the introduction to the crew made me really, really optimistic for this series. It makes me really want to see more now. And the first three chapters, I thought, oh, it's okay. But now it's like, I want to get into Red Sprite.
And there's a mystery of it, too, because we don't actually know what happens. You don't right. see the light. You just see his face reacting to it. I actually thought that in the panel above, that what was his chin was actually his mouth opening. And I thought he, like, opened his mouth and laser cannoned him, which was fucking awesome.
I'm a boss!
Exactly.
Atlas says, asks everyone, are the arrangements to dispose the criminals complete? And everyone's like, yep. We're gonna find the ship in hiding and bury it. Everything is already in motion. We cut back to the crew, and they're, you know, traveling through the clouds. I got kind of confused by what exactly was going on, because this character, Richard Frederick Bristol, who gets introduced, looks very similar to another character who's on Tasu's ship, and so I'm like, wait a minute. But no, he is captaining another ship, which is tracking them down and is trying to take them out. And he is a pretty stereotypical, my life is worth more than those commoners that may die if we happen to hit them by mistake. They are mere second-class citizens. My orders are worth 1,000 lower-class lives. You must remember that. I'm sipping my wine while commanding my vessel.
My tiny wine glass. Anything bigger would just spoil the taste.
I must swirl it and sniff it and spit it there in order to appreciate it, yes.
I must never ingest it, no.
Yeah. Can't hold my liquor. Just inhaling this makes me get a little tipsy. Ooh.
Getting inebriated is for peasants and hobos. Yeah.
He is the pilot of the Excalibur, apparently the most prestigious destroyer-class ship in the fleet, which means I'm sure that it won't be too big difficult for them to fight it off, because it's Chapter 4. But, like I said, really like this chapter, looking forward to more.
Yes.
Now we can move on to Promised Neverland.
Yeah, because we're just saying fuck the alphabet,
Promised Neverland for this week. So, last time, Emma discovered the tracking device in all the little kids' ears, and we get some follow-up on that as all the kids head out for playtime in the field. And Mom has this moment where she says, "Hold on, Emma. You know, your collar is inside out. Let me help it out with you." And then she strokes her behind the ear. And Emma leans in and gives her a peck on the cheek to, you know, of course, maybe, "Oh, yeah, everything's fine." You know. That brings us to our chapter title. Chapter 8, "I Have an Idea," as all of the kids mill about. Krone is at large as well. Krone is like, could never have deceived these children for their entire lives. She looks too evil.
She really doesn't get the idea of a poker face. She's definitely walking into every situation like,
"Your mom is going around like, Emma, you know, your collar's popped up. Come on, give mother a kiss." That's right. And you know, even when she doesn't have any eyes on her, she has this very neutral look on her face. Crowing is out like, "I'm going to make sure those kids don't escape."
"Children, come play with me. I'm innocent."
Too evil. Emma explains to Ray and Norman, "Yeah, the tracking device is in our ears." Then she points out, "Yeah, you know, Mom actually was, when she was touching my hair like that, I think, I have to wonder, like, for our entire lives, whenever she's been getting close to us and being affectionate, was she just doing it in order to check on the tracking devices in our ears?" But I love that those little moments of, like, you know, the world, everything you knew is a lie, moments that they have, and every single little revelation that they have about their lives so far. But they are thinking, okay, you know, next, now for the next part of our plan, we know where the tracking device is. Now we've got to figure out how to actually get rid of it. And Norm points out, you know, if we remove it, then it's how do we prevent her from discovering that we've removed them? Because it's such an easy thing to check. You know, if we try and cover it up, she'll be like, "Why the fuck is your ear covered up?" And she'll know something's up. So what they conclude is, we basically have to wait until right when we're going to get out that we can destroy it, or get rid of it. And Norman raises the question of, well, and even if we destroy it, what if that will actually notify them? What if that's the only time that a warning goes off is when it's destroyed? So they've got to figure out what do we do? They don't know exactly what the details are. When Ray and Norm bring up, yeah, the only thing we can do is destroy it when we're ready to escape. And it was like, well, but then how are we going to figure out how to destroy it if we have to? Ray says, let's see, actually I've got an idea, so you can just leave this issue to me. I'll figure it out. And Norm moves on to the next issue of, okay, now we've got to figure out how to take everyone with us. Because we've got to make sure that everyone can get out of here. And Ray brings up the point, there's all these little kids who aren't good at physical activities. There are babies who can barely walk. They're going to hurt our chances of surviving more than help us. They're going to be a hindrance. And how are we going to get out of here? And Norman thinks to himself, well, in that case, the only way to get out of here is if we kill Mom and the sister. But he doesn't actually speak that aloud. He's just kind of acknowledging the grim possibility, and he flashes back to when Ray flipped the fork around last time. But Emma actually has an idea. So time passes, and Mom approaches Ray when he's under a tree reading the book on his own, and she says, "Where is everyone else then?" "I don't know. Playing tag in the forest, maybe." And it's this big 2-page spread that we get. Really intense, all these, you know, determined kids dashing through the woods, even though they don't know exactly what the purpose of this is. I don't know, there's something about, like, the mean, determined eyes on these little children that I really like.
Well, it also helps that this is a series that, like, you wouldn't expect a lot of 2-page spreads for like this, so it's kind of cool to see, like, an action spread for the series, even though it's just, like, kids playing tag, not realizing they're being trained to escape from homicidal monster aliens.
Demons. We don't know that they're aliens. And then we get a little flashback where I'm explained, yeah, we'll use our game of tag in order to actually physically train them. Norman is it, and he'll essentially train everyone. He'll train everyone to use their body and brains. train them with physical activity and also train them in strategy. And, yeah, Norman and Ray will be the teachers and we'll be the students. And, we see a scene of a little kid with like an onion hairdo, noticing footprints. And he's like, oh, well, let's see. I can erase these and then I'll leave some footprints leading in a direction other than the one that I'm taking. We see one of the older kids testing the wind and then heading in a different direction. Emma leading a bunch of children around. And then we see one kid immediately suddenly get caught by Norman. And he's like, oh, I thought I was doing well. And, Ray starts to, you know, explain things to him. It's like, okay, yeah, you erased your own footprints, but you should also check for Norman's footprints. Then you can tell what's going on. And Ray's thinking to himself, oh, he's doing a good job. He's giving them little hints on what to do. Also, Norman's reading your habits. You're making yourself too easy to predict. He says, oh, yeah, you know, Thomas, this is going on. And then all of a sudden, he realizes, wait a minute, where did Sister Crone go? And, Crone has gone into the woods to, play tag with the children. With the scariest expression you could possibly make when asking children to play tag with them. Cause he's going...
Basically. She also, I don't know if it's hers or she took Mom's, but she has the watch.
Yeah, she's got the little tracking device in order to find the kids. And, of course, I like the little detail where Emma and Norman are really tense because she's joined them in, and there are these little children like, yay, Sister Crone's gonna play with her! Yeah.
She looks terrifying, but I love tag!
I don't know that she wants to feed us to demons, so this pleases me!
I mean, she said it when she came in, but then she said, oops, I didn't mean to say that, so I pretended that it didn't happen!
Yay! I'm a naive child.
I liked the closing of the chapter with the little game of tag, and I swear, like the day that we get a chapter of Promised Neverland that doesn't end on a little cliffhanger moment, it seems like it's going to be that every week at this rate.
It's a good way to do it, though.
Okay, Toriko, 388 main dish. Last time on Toriko. He ate his appetite, and he's fully realized, question mark?
He's gotten super-duper powerful. Also, this just in, Stardrune, maybe not dead. More than that.
Who knows? Acacia rushes in to attack Toriko while he is still recovering from the intensity of the weight of the moment that he just had. And he's thinking to himself, even the tears that fell into my mouth have the most amazing taste. Okay. You are high right now, Toriko. You are high.
Oh, look, even the tears in my mouth have, like, the most amazing taste to them. Super delicious.
Acacia tries to attack Toriko, and I'm not sure exactly what happens here.
Oh, I'll tell you exactly what fucking happens.
Oh, he knocked him around the earth.
Toriko punches Acacia in the face, and it's one of the continuous punches that knocks him all the way around the fucking planet. Until Toriko stops it when he comes up the other side. It is awesome!
And he's not even really thinking about it right now. Because he's going on, it's just like how when you get older, the park you used to play in as a kid looks so small. The world feels so small right now. Oh, this overwhelming appetite. And he's like, what the fuck? You just punched me around the planet!
Holy shit!
And Toriko reflects on this, saying, so this is the power of God, as God is added to Toriko's full course meal, which leaves only the meat dish open, which he's going to take from Neo. And he says, yes, and now I shall take that that is lurking within you along with all the other ingredients, then my full course will be complete, so show your face, Neo. And at that moment, Bambina is back! Yay!
Yay!
Forget Stardrune, Bambina's alive. and Toriko figures, okay, so you recover from eating God as well. What about the other eight kings? And we see the eight kings that were seemingly killed, are starting to recover. Heracles is breathing again. The bird is pretty much still kind of lying there.
The bird's kind of fucked. The Toriko specifically notes, I think, that the Snake King's dead, though. Like, it looks like it's too late for the Snake King.
Because it was kind of...
It was kind of
exploded.
Yeah. And they note, like, oh, because so much the Bird King was eaten by Neo, the Bird King's not going to really do great.
But Toriko looks up and says, all right, God's preparation is complete. Or Komatsu is saying that. He hears Komatsu saying that. Sunny and Coco and Zebra and Tepe?
Yep.
They're all there too. Komatsu and the other chefs come out of God's mouth, and it's like, all right, you were there too, weren't you?
You guys were a thing.
You guys!
Oh, you guys! Komatsu!
And...
Omei? Tsukumi? I want to say?
Guys who trained late at night together.
Komatsu! And the friends!
Komatsu and the rest!
It's a short Sunny theme song. Here on God Frog's Tongue!
So Acacia enters douche mode again. He says, oh, you think the tables have turned? And Midar says, nah, actually, they already turned when I showed up in order to kick your ass. Acacia's like, whatever. Here's a thought. What do you think? Why do you think we eat? Is it to stay alive? Is it to leave behind descendants? No! It is only because we get hungry. We don't eat so that our species will prosper. We don't do it to share something with others. Appetite is self-centered. It's an absolute desire that's put first before anything else. And if you wanted to die, your hunger wouldn't stop. So Toriko doesn't really think about this. He just goes, so hey, Acacia, were we born from your and Froze's love or from your appetites? And Acacia's like, it's just our appetites. Love, anger. They'll swell and burst and then turn to dust and disappear in the face of appetite, which never goes away. They're fleeting and will be crushed into nothing. Midora, even your anger wasn't able to defeat my appetite in the end. Om nom 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 nom.
I actually really like this speech. I think it's kind of interesting. I love his first thing about like what appetite is. It's self-centered. Even no matter what, you can't stop it. And it shows that flashback of Midora pounding his own stomach because he's like, why am I hungry when I'm in mourning? And it's like, it is true. Your body doesn't stop needing the things it needs just because you're sad. You know, it's a universal truth. And I love the way that Toriko asks, like, were we born from love or were we born from your appetite? And he's like, just appetite. It kind of gets away from just saying, I just fucked your mom because I had needs, essentially. And it's kind of gross. Like, it's just like, I didn't want you. You were just a byproduct.
I imagine Acacia makes constant wanking motions when he's talking down to everybody in this series. Oh, you were really angry. Oh, you're sad your brother's dead. Whatever, I'm hungry. I'm going to eat you.
Oh, the Snake King's dead. No, let's all stop and be sad for that.
I do like the little exchange that they have at this point because Midora says, oh, well, so you think that my anger is going to disappear eventually. I do wish that were true. I have high hopes for it. And Acacia says, the flavor of the earth has already grown to its limits. Everything pent up will erupt and scatter, but the taste won't go away. Flavor goes on to become the next flavor being reborn, unlike your trivial emotions. But there is actually one emotion whose flavor I did enjoy. You think that just because you've recovered, all the pieces are in place, but I'm the one who has all his pieces in place. Now, let me devour your despair. He makes a clenching motion with his fist, and a giant hand starts to crush the earth.
Okay.
But Pear says, listen, No matter what happens, do not lose hope. As we cut to inside the Earth and the entrance to Area Zero, where... Brunch?
No.
Not it's, Brunch. It's, who it's, is this?
It's... I call... It's that gourmet hunter. I can't remember his fucking name. Or gourmet monk. What do they call themselves? Iwawa? I can't remember his fucking name.
God, I forgot about him, because even when he said he was going to do this, I forgot about him, and now he looks completely different because he's gotten all transformed.
Yeah, Imaru people are saying, I guess. I don't know. Gourmet Knight, that's what they were called.
Gourmet Knight,
he's the dude every time I fucking became the story, he's like, I don't care about him, do match instead!
he manages to reach Area Zero, where food is just blowing out of a giant volcano. All sorts of food is growing everywhere. Everything is edible. You can eat almost everything you see.
It's weird, because it's literally an eruption of food, and you're like, oh, okay, it erupts food. It also apparently erupts cans and pigs in a blanket. it erupts complete packaged foods, too, and, like, complete dishes, like, as opposed to just, like, oh, fucking spaghetti's raining and bananas. It's like, nah, it's a pig in a blanket.
Awesome. There's a sushi flower right here. Sweet.
Yeah. Cheesy gordita crunch is right up there.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that was an alright chapter.
I like this chapter a lot. I loved the speech that Acacia gave. I thought it was really intimidating. I like how the only, like, in this entire discussion about how, like, there is no point to all this, man just hungers and I'm the most powerful, at the end he, like, kind of betrays it all by being like, oh, but I have one human emotion. I fucking love watching you people despair. Like, it's just, like, such a shitty villain, like, dick move. Although this has been the year of despair in Shonen Jump. Between him and Veto, and I think even Uobach did some of that, too.
Do not lose hope, Ichigo. Let's move on to World Trigger. Chapter 159, Hughes, Part 3. We see some of the results of Hughes's little entrance exam, and he breezed the fuck through it. Seemingly, at least as easily as Yuma. Because he takes down the other neighbor in 1.5 seconds. And they're like, oh my god, what a great score! The second best ever! And he's like, what, just the second? I can do it again. Let me try again.
I am kind of turning around on Hughes. He's starting to become funny to me.
But aside from just the claw.
Yeah, aside from the claw, I'm starting to see just how straight-faced and serious he is, how funny that can be in the comparison to the rest of the world now.
We get a little bit of a recap. Saying, okay, yeah, you know, if you reach 4,000 points for the training sessions in the Solo Rank Wars, then you get to promote to B rank automatically. And there's also one other thing you can do that you must do in the upcoming training course. Everyone in this room has Solo points, and we start them at 1,000. Normally, what we do is evaluate your skills during a probationary enlistment prior to the induction ceremony. Depending on your performance, you get bonus Solo points. It's standard procedure, but since you all enlisted during a regular part of the season, didn't have time for it. So instead, you're going to take a quick skill test. We're going to separate you into groups of 5, and you'll fight each other in a VR space. Anybody that isn't you is your enemy. You receive 120 points for each enemy you take down, and we reshuffle the groups after each battle. This will continue until each of you has fought in 4 matches, and the more people you defeat, the closer you get to B rank. Cut to Hughes murdering everyone.
It's a 2-page spread of him instant killing all 4 other people he's fighting in 1 attack.
The last one, you don't even see, like, his follow-through motion. He's just kind of holding the sword.
You have to almost just assume that the people just start flying back out of, like, instinct. Like, ah! It's like, I didn't even draw my weapon yet.
And so he gets 3,000 points right off the bat. He's like, okay, I still need 1,000 points more. So he gets put in a little...
He does essentially the
one-on-one. The three douche-gateers are like, oh, hey, there's this one guy who's got 3,000 points. Well, anyone can really get that with dumb luck. Well, guess we'll show him the wall that separates us from the rest. Cut to him murdering each of them in turn, looking even more bored than he did before. He's like, and then he goes over to the instructors. He's like, look, I passed 4,000. Is this good enough? Yep, congratulations. Use this now, B-Rank! Oh, boy. But it doesn't stop there, because a bunch of B-Rank attackers, including some of the ones that we've seen in previous sessions against Tamakoma Squad, notice that there is a rookie making waves and is already B-Rank. And they're like, oh, we could have a practice session with this guy. Well, he's only got the one trigger. He doesn't even have a shield. So how about we all just use a sword? How about we don't bet our points? And then we'll just have a little sparring session that way. And he says, well, this is a good opportunity for me to gain meat and strength. And also, it will allow me to get used to using this sword. Sure. They're like, okay, I'll go first.
Yeah, he insta-kills all of them.
It gradually, he finally does get to a point where it's Sasamori, I think?
Yes, and he is, I'm trying to remember which group he was with.
He's on Sua Squad.
Sua, okay.
And he manages to score 1 point on Hughes. So Hughes beats him 5-1 as opposed to 5-0. So they're like, oh, good job! You managed to take 1 point from him! There's one of the attackers is like, I bet he could actually defeat us when we're fully geared. And like, okay, well, let's not go that far yet. Let's not get carried away here. He's good, and he did kick our asses, but shut up.
Yeah, stop.
And they keep on calling people over. They get one of the guys from Nina Mia Squad over.
That's like, yeah. Really significant to me.
Yeah.
Because Nina Mia Squad's almost certainly going to be an opponent either next match or the match after. Mm-hmm. And now one of their people has knowledge of how Husei fights. Like,
yeah.
Husei beat him 5-2, but that's still a significant piece of scouting knowledge to have.
Yeah. And this is the first time that he's even, like, trying to fight the guy. He wasn't observing the fights before at all. Mm-hmm. So they're like, wow, this guy's crazy. He beats him 5-2, but Hughes even noticed this guy is actually way tougher than the others I've fought so far. And so they're like, oh my god, how the... You only got two against this guy. What is this? And Sujiya says, yeah, his sword skills are really good. I wonder if he is a trained swordsman and he's got some sort of specialty with it. Then one of them notices that,
Kakoma.
Not him. The other one.
Arashiyama.
Arashiyama. Ikoma has shown up and he's bugging Arashiyama. He just comes up behind him and pokes him in the cheek.
I don't understand this. He just, like, because clearly Arashiyama's, like, he's observing it because he's one of the instructors. And you just see Arashiyama or Ikoma walk up and just pokes him in the face. Like, and he's still wearing his goggles, so you can't see much of his expression. He just walks up and is like, sup. It's like, what? Ikoma's so fucking random.
So Korai spots this. Korai from, okay, what's his squad again? It's, Azuma Squad. And he's like, hey, Yuko, can you come over here? And Yuko's like, what's up, Koala? So weird. World Trigger's off next week, and I'm infuriated about this, because I'm like, oh my god, is Ikoma going to kick Hughes' ass, and Hughes and Ikoma are gonna be forever rivals? I want that to happen so bad.
It's good to see that at least Ikoma is still playing a part in the story, too.
Mm-hmm. Sticking him around after that match, yeah. I want Ikoma to fucking destroy Hughes. And for Hughes to be his rival. Because can you imagine those two personalities going off of each other? Hughes the forever straight man and Ikoma the fucking weirdo.
If they ever talked, you'd need to have, like, you need to have someone just completely absurd nearby them so they could both bounce off the one, like, freak, because otherwise they're both just going to be so straight-laced and weird, it's just a coma's insane while he's doing it.
I mean, this was not an especially good chapter. It's not...
It's it's okay.
It's got some character development here and there, but I mean, it's not an incredibly exciting one. It's just like, yeah, Hughes is really good.
It was sort of like, it was a foregone conclusion Hughes was going to make B rank. So you could have either done it in like a throwaway moment and been like, Hughes made B rank, or you could have made a chapter out of it, which they did, which was mostly just full of comedy and things like that, which it was all funny. Like, I laughed at what I, you know, was supposed to, and I am excited to see what's going to happen when he goes against, Ikoma, but yeah, it's not a very substantial chapter. It's kind of a disappointing one to have to get a break on, but it was still a good chapter.
Mm-hmm. That's going to do it for a weekly manga recap this week. So let's do our favorites. Let's do our MVPs and our favorite series of the week, then. I'll go ahead and go first. I went with One Piece again this week. Just a very effective flashback chapter.
Okay.
A lot more to say.
You know, I'm torn on this one.
There were some good chapters this week, honestly.
You know what? I'm gonna go with the first thought that came to my mind, and I'm gonna give it to World Trigger this, or not World Trigger, sorry. My Hero Academia.
I was about to say, it's like, that was kind of the least exceptional one out of all the Jump series.
My Hero Academia.
I thought it was a good one. For our MVPs, I know that y'all are thinking I'm going to say Aoyama or Ida, but I'm actually going to go with Atlas, because he made a really good first impression on me, and I really want to see more from him.
No, I completely understand that. In return, I will go say Ida, though. That was a standout moment for me. I thought he was great. I liked Aiyawa as well, but for me, it was nicer to see Ida get that moment, because it's such a small moment, too, and I think those are really what helped make a character.
And I will say that Ida would have taken it for me if not for reading Red Sprite and getting that moment, because I actually didn't read Red Sprite until today. Mm-hmm. So I definitely changed my mind around. And One Piece reads wins our viewer poll this week. Takes it almost 2-1 over the next series afterwards. So pretty big landslide for One Piece. And I think I get the impression that trend might continue as we get into this flashback, because One Piece flashbacks are always heart-wrenching as hell.
Yes. Real quick here, before we get into too many plugs or anything like that, I want to throw a real quick mention out there once again. Annalise has the contest, the World Trigger contest that she's currently doing right now. She's getting prepared to send a package to Ashihara Sensei, and in the package, she's looking for people to send in any fan art, any fan letters. I'm actually sending in a letter. I've already gotten it ready. I just have to send it out. Any gifts you want to give him, anything like that. And if you send it in this month, you have a chance to win a volume of the New World Trigger manga, and Annalise will draw you any scene from World Trigger to My Heart and Back Door, the next part. I will try to put a cherry on the top of this one. I'm going to give her a number, essentially, of entries I want to see in this. If we reach that number, the next part of World Trigger My Heart and Back Door will come out. It's going to be
okay. You heard it here, folks.
So we need people. I'm going to tell you right now. It's going to be
Part 5/ whatever numbering scheme it's on.
Oh no, you didn't realize this is actually 0, the strongest part of all. So if you want to see it, just say it, because this is the thing. We have so many people in this.
We almost made it through an episode without making a Bleach reference.
We have so many people in this podcast, listeners, who like World Trigger, that you could easily just send. It doesn't have to be anything elaborate. You just need to see, like, hey, thanks Ashihara, I love this manga, send him any thoughts you have. You can send him a joke. You can send him a drawing, you know? We have people who do fan art, things like that. Anything like that. Fan fiction, that will work too. Anything like that. Just send it over to Annalise. You could reach her Kaito_Ace. The information's actually above the chat on Hitbox, and if you're listening to this afterwards on YouTube or iTunes, @Kaito_Ace. Check that out, basically, and send something in, and we'll get some cool stuff out of that.
All right. All right, plug-in time. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here for Weekly Mug Recap. We record the show on hitbox.tv/RoloT, normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change things up, change the record time, change the location if there is some sort of a problem with the stream. But that's normally what we do, and if you want to stay updated on any changes like that, you want to know exactly when we start streaming, then you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow @WMRPodcast and your hosts @RoloT, @WhyRolyOverTime. Check out all of our past episodes on weeklymongrecap.podbean.com, on our YouTube channel, as well as on iTunes. And if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, be sure to leave a comment or rating so that you can help us beat the woodworkers in the hobby section on iTunes.
One day,
we shall be number one! Be sure to send us criticism, ask us questions, make suggestions for future manga for us to read. We are currently preparing to get into Halloween month right now, so if you got some horror ideas that you want us to cover, then now is definitely the time to send those to us. Although we are going to start with the scariest series of them all next week, Air Gear. Email all those things to us. weeklymongrecap@yahoo.com is the place to send them. Yes. Special thanks go out to all the people who make this podcast possible. First off, our Patreon supporters. You can support us at patreon.com/weeklymongrecap. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. Thank you so much for all the support that we've gotten so far.
I need to interrupt, guys. We have a new review, new 5-star review from G4Life, who says, "Great manga podcast, enough said." So thank you, G4Life. You know what? When one day this becomes the biggest manga podcast and we've taken over a small micronation, G4Life, you get to be the head of the Department of Agriculture, which is a prime position. You don't have to do a whole lot. That's bureaucracy is going to handle most of it. It's just a cushy, high-paying job. And you don't know just why. Gonna get
considering it's a micronation, you really just got to like water the plants every couple of days.
Yeah, you need to know a couple different like kinds of apples and shit. Like it's an easy job. And you
know, even if you don't know the apples, like you'll know more than us.
Yeah, and that's why you just need to send it in, because when positions of power are being handed out, it's going to be real G's, like G for Life, that get them.
We remember the people who helped us out at the beginning.
Yes.
And we remember those who didn't.
Yeah. Like that jerking off elephant. He never forgets.
Oh, boy.
Also, we do have some new patrons, by the way. I want to give a special thanks to John F.D. Lebrano and Tim Gaughan. Thank you both.
And, of course, thanks go out to Steam Anor Talker. You can check out his work in a number of different places. He's got his own Patreon you can check out as well. And Infamous Planet, who helps us with the visual presentation of the show. Thank you guys so much. Next week's the big one.
I can't stress it. This next week...
We've been doing this podcast for, what, like 5 years now?
Coming up on 6 next year, yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing it for over 5 years now, and during that entire time, this series has been a little story shared around the campfire by Chris, but we're going to delve into this.
I'm not even going to lie. There's a chance that even if, you know, no matter what series are, we might not even have time to do the recap if we just need to shit on this series for that long. There's a lot of horseshit to talk about, and this series went on for a really long time.
I mean, it might not even be a matter of, like, time constraints. It might just be a matter of, like, after we're done talking about it, we don't want to talk about manga anymore.
I'm just like, and there's no fucking World Trigger. So that's the podcast, everybody. Thanks. So
what's the point of covering the rest of this?
Yeah. Why bother?
So get ready, guys. Like, mount up.
I want to give you a small heads up on what to expect. So some people have been asking, like, because I mentioned I've been buying the physical volumes. They're like, why are you buying the physical volumes, Chris? That's so expensive. This is volume one, which you see I've tabulated to certain instances of the series that I am going to go to in reference to talk about how fucking stupid it is.
And that is when the series was actually about inline skating wars and nothing else.
This is when it wasn't crazy, stupid, dumb. Just regular dumb.
This is before girls who tune the skates for some reason have to dress up in things that make them look naked because the suits even conform around their nipples. This is before the wheels contain element controlling devices. This is before the frickin' genetics gravity children reveal. It's already stupid.
Yes. So, be prepared. Next week is... It's an episode you don't want to miss. If your, like, iPod or whatever breaks, steal someone else's. You don't want to miss this episode. But you know what? I want to promote, like, togethership. So instead, break into someone else's house and listen to the episode with them. And then tell that person to put a 5-star review on iTunes.
And then have them break into someone else's house.
Yeah, yeah. Pay it forward.
See, guys, if every person that you find then breaks into two other people's houses...
We shouldn't have to explain math to you guys. It's pretty simple.
Final disclaimer, Wikimanga Recap is not responsible for anyone who chose to break into anyone else's house. Bye!